Molly Hilly was the musical director of the Unitarian Church on 8th Street here in Los Angeles for 50 years. And he was the artistic director. And this was during the time when at that church, the balcony was full because it became a hideout and a refuge and a gathering place for the blacklisted artists of Los Angeles during the 50s. And they would go there and they'd do shows and they would entertain each other as they had been entertaining the entire country, but were no longer allowed to put their names on their work, or to, in many cases, even do their work because they were labeled as communists or fellow travelers. Molly Hilly published The People's Songbook, which is a very popular songbook from that era. One time, Molly Hilly was in New York, in Harlem, with Paul Robeson. And Paul Robeson walked out on the street, Molly behind him, and all of a sudden, of course, a crowd began to gather, and people began to come from all around until the whole street was full of people, and they began to shout, "Sing for us, sing for us." And Paul Robeson said, "Well, how can I? I don't have a piano." You know. And a whole bunch of fellas, three guys, ran up three stories of steps, picked up a piano, and carried it back down to the street and set it down next to Paul Robeson. And Molly Hilly sat down and played, and Paul Robeson sang on the streets of Harlem that day.
Okay, that's Lee Beck of the Public Works Improvisational Theater talking about Paul Robeson singing on the streets of Harlem. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson with my co-host, Earlene Anthony, coming at you from Skid Row Studios. Our call-in number is 800-893-9562. Listen to us live, or you can download our show and any past show by Googling in skitrow.la and hit Qumran Report. Now, this week on the Qumran Report, we will spend the entire hour talking to Lee Beck, Artistic Director of Public Works Improvisational Theater. Lee Beck has been an integral part of Public Works Improvisational Theater since the 1970s. He took over as artistic director of the company in 2001 after founding member Marlene Resnick passing. The California native, born in 1941, has had successful careers as a fundamentalist evangelist preacher, radio host, actor, writer, producer, union organizer, husband, father, and grandfather to many, and champion for the underserved and wrong. He is a staple for the Silver Lakes arts community and continues to be on the forefront of accessible, socially relevant performing arts production. Also in the studio with Lee is Nolan Porter, David Ruff, and Eric Vormo. Welcome to the Qumran Report.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, man.
Thank you to be here.
Yes, I want to start off with the question, what is improvisational theater? Let's start off there.
It's been described in a wonderful book. I can't remember the name of the fellow that wrote it. Maybe Eric can. But something wonderful right away. Mm-hmm. And the idea is was really kind of developed by a woman by the name of Viola Spolin, who wrote the book, The Bible of Improvisational Theater, which is improvisational theater games for the theater. And she began playing theater games in the slums, or in the slums of Chicago, and began developing a series of games to remove you from feeling like you have to act. In other words, you're just playing a game with each other, and this developed, and it was great for children, and it developed and developed into a great company, and out of which eventually came things like Second City, Saturday Night Live, and numerous great companies across the country, And, of course, Paul Sills, the great director from Chicago, was her son. And he continued in her footsteps, and he made it very famous, took it to Broadway even, his Story Theater, and it became a very big thing. And on the West Coast, we had the committee when I first became aware of improvisational theater. And, of course, you know, it's a natural impulse, too, to make things up. You know, I can remember the first thing I ever improvised. I must have been 6 years old, and I remember we were playing in a tent with a bunch of kids, and I got so into it that I started to cry because it was some kind of a tragic story, and I got so caught up in it, and it felt so real, the story, that it really affected me emotionally, you know. So it's something that comes, with public works, our work has always come from our personal experience. We develop things out of what we've been doing, our activism, our communications, our, you know, where we lived and what we've been doing, the things we got involved in. We always, as artists, found a way to make a play out of it or make a performance out of it. And and improvisation is like that.
Okay.
In the early days of public works, we often asked for dreams from the audience and improvised stories based on the dreams and so on. Maybe Eric would like to expand on that a little.
Well, I know the story of Viola Spolin. Because she worked at the Hull House that was started by Jane Addams there in Chicago, and largely worked with immigrants. And so one aspect of the work was to create new Americans from these immigrants.
Mm-hmm. And that's right. That's how she started.
Yep. Thank you, Dave. And so when they introduced the theater games, it almost gave the people the chance to like try on this new identity without thinking to themselves, I can't hardly speak the language and I don't know the customs, but to just have this imaginative space in order to experiment on becoming Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she took that idea and it was such a instant or such a ready idea that she was able to incorporate and teach theater students.
Mm-hmm.
Now it went beyond the her initial thing of teaching immigrant children, which was very successful, to being developing into theater games for actors in general and acting students in general. It's not about being funny. It's about theater games are about making you at ease in the place, so you're not all tied up. You're not all concerned about what you're doing. You kind of focus on where you are on you know, and focus on your character. And the theater games help you. They help you memorize your lines if you have lines, but they can also help you come up with ways of developing a character, ways of being a character. All different things, physical things, mental things. That help you act and help you improvise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the difference between improvisational theater and traditional theater?
All right, I'll answer that. Well, the ancient Greeks, the Athenians, they created drama. It means to put into action, but they initially created it, and actors were schooled in their case, they would don a mask that they called a persona, and there was a little cone in there so that their voices would project to audiences. And so they didn't use their face to communicate. They used their body, and they danced, and they emotionally emoted the character. Then the Romans picked up on that and were inspired by the Greeks, but with the era of Christianity, the theater world was completely eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
And it only came back in the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance period when they would have mystery plays and morality plays to tell stories from the Bible. And that's the kind of thing that inspired Shakespeare, And then you get a much more elaborated theater during his time.
The mode of theater that Eric mentions is essentially involved in technique. As you don a particular mask, you don a character, you learn your lines exactly, everything, every single line exactly. If you vary from the script even slightly, somebody, you know, hits you over the head. that mode of theater was in place until the early 20th century. Actors were rewarded and allotted for being totally true to the script and bringing that particular character as close to what was before as possible. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until method acting, wasn't until
Stanislavski.
Much later that people figured out that there were different ways of putting on theater.
Mm-hmm.
Improvisation can mean specific improvisation about the way you present a character, still sticking essentially with the lines, or it can mean making up the story entirely.
Now, I've heard the two types of improvisation. I've heard the concept that they're what you call textual improvisation and non-textual improvisation. You know, improvisation where you use a script. And then non-textual, I heard that you use the five concepts, what they call the five W's, you know, who, what, where, when.
Yeah.
And you provide some of these elements in it. And another thing that I've noticed about modern theater is how they use theater games to warm up. A lot of the actors, I noticed in the process that I'm involved in right now over to the Roby, and I'm watching them put Bronzeville together. And it's amazing to watch the director, Ben Guillory, work and how at the beginning of just about all of his rehearsal, he started off with rehearsal games to relax the actors.
I'd like to add something
screen.
To that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't give you the definition of improvisational theater, but I can tell you how it's affected me.
Mm-hmm.
I came from a background that was all very structured. I was either singing from a script, reading from a script, singing a song that had been written with so many bars, so the words a certain way. And I found out working with Lee, all that went out.
Okay?
So true.
I was terrified and excited at the same time, because I always had to be in the moment. And that's the only way that I could work with Lee and Marlene, as I was so structured, and all of a sudden, you know, no matter what we rehearsed for days or hours, I knew it. Well, I learned that it was going to be a lot different.
He was playing the music.
I was playing the music.
Even harder.
So from being very structured, I had to, if their mood changed, maybe what I had planned to play that night, I had to change it and let it fit the mood.
So the music was improvisational.
The music was improvisational and part of the theater. Yeah. And the music was to complement the words and the dialogue and the dialogue.
Action.
It was to inspire, the action inspired the music.
Yeah.
And it was terrifying and exciting, and actually, I think, made me a performer that is much more in touch with myself in the moment.
It was amazing. Great watching him get into that. When he first started, like you say, he was he wanted to have everything set up, one song, another song, another song, and when he finally figured out that it was all about the moment, that was great, and he was wonderful. The first time we put on Confessions of a Pulpiteer, he and Lee did wonderful work together, almost trading off like a tag team as far as the music and as far as the musical background. All of it improvised. The whole show was improvised that first time.
Mm-hmm. Now, because, you know, in the world of theater, they always say that the difference between a play and the movies is that in a play, if you do 10 performances, every performance would be different.
You betcha.
It's really like that with the whole concept of improvisation.
You bet.
Okay, I tell you what. Let's go to a clip from an interview that I did with Lee, and then we'll come back with our discussion.
Started in 1974 by Marlene Rasnick and Dale Unson Morris. That was the name at the time. She dropped the Morris eventually and just went by Dale Unson.
How do I spell? You spell Marlene's first and last name.
M-A-R-L-E-N-E Rasnick, R-A-S-N-I-C-K. And they loved improvisation. They had both done some work with the committee, and in fact, Dale and they had taught a lot of classes and workshops. In fact, Robin Williams cites Dale Unson whenever they interview him with the first improv class he ever took at Claremont. So, you know, that was kind of a neat connection for her. And she was really quite great. They have both passed on from cancer. Dale got lung cancer and Marlene got ovarian cancer. And they died around 10, 12 years ago.
Who passed first?
Marlene passed first. She passed away 12 years ago, and then Dale died a couple years later. And they were part of the women's movement, as we call it, and they were very independent people. And Dale was married to Jim Kahn, who was the minister at the church in Ocean Park, which was just kind of starting up. And Jim, you know, told him, yeah, you should work here. So they kind of became the house theater company. And they did an improvised show every Friday night for like 10 years. I mean, they sustained for a long time. And they had people like Severn Darden played a lot with them, Elizabeth St. Clair, Norbert Weiser was one of the original members. He's been in a lot of movies. And Daryl Larson, another good actor who's now living in New York. And Eleanor Graham. And several other people, you know, I'll try to maybe get a list of everybody.
Okay. How do Dale spell all that?
D-A-L-E Unson, E-U-N-S-O-N.
Okay.
And so they went on for quite a few years, just never really doing a play, but doing live improvised shows with suggestions from the audience. You know, like they would get an audience member to tell a dream. And then they would do the dream. They would improvise the dream. And they did what's called the Herald, which is a way of doing improv. You know, it's kind of popular now in improv circles. But it went for several years where nobody did it, and now it's kind of made a comeback the last few years. But they were doing it way back then. And, of course, the church in Ocean Park was a very political, you know, church. It was very involved in the community. There came a lot of organizations to help with education, take care of the homeless, and do all kinds of really cool things.
Was it a Methodist?
It's a Methodist church.
Oh, United Methodist.
Yes, it's on 2nd and Hill Street in Ocean Park.
Okay.
And in fact, Jim Kahn eventually became the mayor of Santa Monica, mainly through all the political involvement that we all participated in that era.
The mayor of Santa Monica?
Yeah, he became the mayor eventually.
Okay, that's Lee Bagg talking about the beginnings of Public Works Improvisational Theater Companies. Let's get some comments and more discussion from the round table.
Well, let's see. As I was listening to that, I just had a bit of a reverie thinking of it, because the first time I attended was I came to Los Angeles and I found a little ad in the beachfront paper about an improv class, and I was living near the church in Ocean Park, which is where the class was. That was the home of Public Works when they started up. And so I went down there, and Marlene was the teacher, and she lined us all up on the wall. David was in that class, and she lined us all up on the wall, and then chose me to roll with her across the floor. So she laid down on the floor, and I laid down on top of her, and we rolled across the floor. And I often say, and we kept rolling for the next 30 years, because we became husband and wife and lived together for 30 years until she passed away from ovarian cancer.
Marlene was really tall.
Yeah,
you know, she was and tall. And essentially she chose Lee because he was actually a little taller than she was.
But I'm not as tall as David.
Yeah, but if I'd rolled on top of her, she never would have recovered.
Okay. Any more comments from the round table? Okay, let me ask this question. What do you think it takes to make theater both political and entertaining?
My approach has been more cultural, you know, starting with, you know, culture as being the story we tell ourselves about who we are, and trying to do political theater, but to give it some history. In our case, for instance, we did a show about Ralph Waldo Emerson, and he was a great American author, and had as a good friend Henry David Thoreau, and it was Thoreau that decided that he wouldn't pay taxes to support the war against Mexico and Texas, and so he spent the night in jail, and he wrote about it, and he talked about this kind of passive resistance. And so, of all people, Leo Tolstoy in Russia was putting together an anthology, and he included Thoreau's essay. And that anthology was picked up in Africa by Mohandas Gandhi before he went back to India. And he used that method of nonviolent confrontation. And so then he inspired Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to like thread through the history to show the origins and some of the different manifestations of political activism.
Mm-hmm.
And but I my first love is literature, and so I like to do it by further explaining authors' works and how often authors were, you know, using their books as a form of a conversation with their contemporaries of the issues that really they took to heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eric is our developmental director, and he is and has been the host of a show called Voice in the Well, and of a group, and he gathers a lot of actors together and performers, musicians, and people with literary knowledge, and he creates a very terrific salon, European-styled salon, which we do in the attic of the Warszawa restaurant. The next one is on June the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And at 7:30. And we do one, he does one pretty much every month. You know, we take time off now and then, but...
Different location?
No, always, well, once in a while we do them at the Ruskin Theater. He does them at the Ruskin Theater. Yeah. And...
We used to be at an independent bookstore in the Palisades, and unfortunately had to close.
Yeah, we did them there for a while.
Okay, well, let me ask this question.
You're asking how to make theater both political and entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Public Works has it always used the actual political activities that the members have been involved in as a basis for improvising plays. For instance, Left of Crystal Pier was about the displacement of people in Venice, California?
Ocean Park.
Ocean Park.
The gentrification of Ocean Park.
Up South was about the 1988
Jesse Jackson campaign
primaries
in
Jesse
Iowa.
Jesse Jackson and they were involved in the Jesse Jackson campaign.
You did a play called Up South.
It was all about the actual people involved in it. You know, they had actually been there in Iowa, and it talked about what they went through. You know, like freezing their tukuses off, etc. and also confronting the very very racist policies attitude of some of the people there. We did a show. What's the name of the show? We did a show immediately following the riots in 1992, all about
A Thousand Points of Light.
That was the name of it.
Thousand
Points of Light.
It had some amazing things, including hopefulness. You know, hope in the midst of chaos and destruction.
Well, let me ask this question then: why do you think so many of the early theater companies and cultural arts organizations were run mainly by so many what you call communists and radicals, especially Provincetown Players, you know, with Max Eastman, Jack Reed, Jiggs Cooks, where Eugene O'Neill, Paul Robeson, that's where he got his start at. Why do you think so many radicals and communists came out of those early movements?
Fellow travelers.
I think it comes from the early days of the labor movement, where songs and plays and other things were used as recruiting techniques to get people involved in the labor movement, to get them excited and to give them a visual.
And also a way that the disparate nationalities could communicate with one another through
song.
Through song and movement.
You teach people who speak 27 different languages, you teach them a song. You teach them all the same song. They're going to get together. They're going to learn that song.
Yeah.
They're going to sing that song. And it helps, it binds them. Who's our guy?
Joe Hill. We've been working the last few years about in the labor history with Andy Griggs and the L.A. Labor Fest here in Los Angeles, and we've been producing shows about the bombing of the L.A. Times, the Bread and Roses strike in Massachusetts, and Joe Hill, and a lot of different things. And it's been very interesting to see that connection and how the arts played an important role even in that in those major.
Don't moments. Forget the old Federalist Theater also.
That's right.
In the 1930s, there was a social movement, and also it was tied to in Russia at the time. I think there's a lot of hope for communism in Russia. I guess this is right after Stalin or before then, and there were people here also that saw that. Their movement there, they associated with the movement in Russia, the social movement.
Before,
here.
That even started, they were anarchist cells all across the United States before communism even became a word.
In the early days, at the turn of the century, anarchism,
socialism, and anarchism,
not communism. Mm-hmm. They didn't call it communism; they called it anarchism and then socialism.
And that's I'm glad you mentioned that about the Federal Theater Projects. Because I've always traced that period as a high point and a low point, in the cultural history of the United States. Because with the Federal Theater Project, it was a time when we had a national theater company that was subsidized by the United States. Yeah. And and they felt there was too many radicals and communists involved. And I had a chance to go to where they had their archives, and I was just amazed. Of all of these plays and playwrights, the archives is at George Mason University at Fairfax is where they got all of the documents at from the Federal Theater Project. Yeah.
And one thing I used to love about the movies that came out of that period, I think there's film noir sort of come out of that period. The stars of the movies were cab drivers. Maybe a window dresser.
Working class.
And then there's a lot of movies made in the 40s about just working class people, and of course that changed.
Yeah, because I think the Federal Theater Project, it provided the pattern for diversity, because you had the Yiddish theater, you had the Negro theater, you name it, you had the Spanish regular, so many different kind of ethnic theater that you had during that particular time, and I always thought it was a shame for them to. Blame the communists, as they say, the fellow travelers and all of that.
The play that really broke its back was It Can't Happen Here, which was about sort of a fascist takeover of America, kind of based on Huey P. Long's rise to power, And we've been we've been trying to figure out a way we could do it again, but it's a long play.
Yeah. Who was the author, the playwright? It came in.
That's Sinclair Lewis.
Sinclair Lewis.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he used to be. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature, and he was very highly thought of and widely read, and that's it's a shame that he's not better read.
He's a known name in literature, definitely, for sure. Right. But I had no idea he was connected.
But there was such a backlash to that play that it kind of began the shutting down of the.
And you say it was a long play.
Oh yeah, huge.
Well, go ahead.
Yes, it's a long play. A long time ago, remember, we used to go see two movies on one night. And that, the idea of spending 3 or 4 hours at the theater, it appealed to people right there at the advent of radio and before television.
Although I don't know the name of the piece, but there was just recently been done a play in New York that's 8 hours long.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have some friends who attended it.
Now, is there... is there a radical theater movement going on now besides the public work improvisational theater, definitely a radical theater movement? Is there any other groups that's...
I'm sorry. I'm sure there are.
There's a couple of there's a couple of groups that work in like Lee was involved with a Latino group that a Mexican American group that that has done several plays, including one that they do every year about the Silver Dollar, about
the Silver Dollar Bar, the Silver Dollar Bar about Ruben Salazar and his murder in the Silver Dollar Bar. We did that as Theater Verite, and I had the privilege of being in that a few times and doing that with them.
Okay, look, let's play another clip from the interview with Lee, and then we'll come back to our discussion.
All kinds of different groups spun off of that, not theater companies, but activist groups, you know, for the homeless, for the education, for, you know, all different kinds of advocacies. And Santa Monica was really, Ocean Park especially, was a real hotbed of political action. And there was a big movement to, you know, stop the development of Ocean Park, in other words, to keep it from having high rise. Casting shadows on the beach, you know, kind of thing.
This was in the 70s?
Yes.
Okay.
It started in 74, and then they I came into the scene just about the time that the women decided they wanted to do a play about women and money, and they didn't want any men in it. And this caused a big row among the men, and the men kind of just dropped out of the company. Oh, Danny Goldman, who's became a casting director, but he's an excellent actor, been in quite a few good movies, was also in that company and was one of the founding members of it. And they were really great. They did this ongoing serial, which they improvised. I can't remember the name of it. It was about an apartment house, so they'd had couples in each room, and their stories, you know, it was very clever. And they played theater games and stuff to develop it. And they had great ensemble. They were really terrific. And I was just, you know, and I was living in Sacramento at the time. And I was doing my Brotherly Love Survival Revival Hour show and stuff. And then when that all played out and stuff, then I was doing a one-man show in a kind of a nightclub restaurant. And afterwards, a fella came up to me and said, by then everybody knew I was going to L.A., and he said, you know, when you go to L.A., you should look up Synergy Trust, which was a theater company that Marlene and Dale had prior to Public Works.
How do you spell it?
Synergy, S-Y-N-R-G-Y, Synergy. It kind of means, you know, coming together. Synergy Trust, and they actually performed up here in what eventually became the feed store on Hyperion. Now it's something else, I don't know what it is now, but it was a feed store for many years after that. And it was funny, because because this guy suggested I get a hold of them when I come to L.A. But it, that company was over by the time I got here. And they had started Public Works. And I was staying in Santa Monica with my buddy Mitch Greenhill, who's a terrific musician. He and his family have managed some of the great folk musicians. Manny Greenhill, his dad, was a pal of Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, and managed Joan Baez from the beginning of her career until the late 70s. And they managed Taj Mahal, and they continue. The company continues. Manny's gone now, but Mitch and his son Matty carry on, and they have lots of really terrific. They've become more international in the groups that they manage and play. They book them and manage them and make sure they get from gig to gig. But I was staying with him because he had been the lead guitar player in a band I used to manage in Sonoma County, and he and I were like brothers, or are like brothers, and are brothers, and so I came down to see him mainly. I came to L.A. because I wanted to hang out with him a little bit because he'd been in Boston for a couple of years after the band broke up. I hadn't seen him, and he really kind of introduced me to a higher level of showbiz and music and the whole nine yards.
Okay, that's Lee Bat talking about some of the history of the Public Works improvisational theater. I want to ask one more question before we go into the community calendar. Can you tell us about why did it move from Senator Trust to Public Works improvisational theater? How did that come about?
I'm not really sure. I think, when you have a theater company, there's a lot of volatile energy. There's a lot of sometimes disagreements. Sometimes people begin to, sometimes there's power struggles and all kinds of things. I'm not quite sure just what it was that caused the move. Maybe it was just a desire to be on the west side after having been on the east side, because the Synergy Trust was on Hyperion Avenue in Silver Lake area, which in a place which eventually became the feed store, which isn't even the feed store anymore. But for many years, it was a feed store where you could go and buy chickens and chicken feed and rabbit feed. When I first came to town, yeah. That's what it was. It was run by this wonderful Caribbean fella. But but I don't know exactly why, but eventually Marlene and Dale were without a company, and they decided to they'd like to start a company. And Dale was married to Jim Kahn. He suggested they started at the church in Ocean Park, and that began their history in Ocean Park.
Okay, we'll come back for more discussions. Let's move to our community calendar, and then we'll come back.
This is a community calendar for the month of June. Thursday, June the 6th. At 8 p.m., Story Field, hosted by Lee Beck. There will be music, storytelling, and poetry. The location of this event is the Art Share, 801 East 4th Place, Los Angeles, and there is free parking. Lee Beck will probably have more to say on this event later on in the program. The next Veterans Community Theater Workshop will be held on Tuesday, June 11th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. is free to veterans and non-veterans. The location is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard. This is near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic, and the Metro bus number 60 and 66 stops right near or close to the corner. For more information, you can call 213-908-6587. The Roby Theater Company will present Bronzeville. Learn how a little-known period in the history of Los Angeles helped shape the city we have now. These are some of the things that will be going on during the productions of Bronzeville. June the 1st through the 30th, exhibition of work by Kathy Foley Meyer. The location will be the Union Center for Arts. June 29th through July 21st will be the stage play production of Bronzeville, written by Tim Toyama and Aaron Wolford, directed by Ben Guillory. The location will be the LATC, Los Angeles Theater Center, 514 South Spring Street. On June the 22nd, there will be a symposium moderated by Dr. Krista Jimenez-West and Dr. Hillary Jinks with Dr. Anthony Macias. The location will be the Downtown Independence Theater. June the 23rd, there will be a live jazz concert at the Blue Whales featuring the Miguel Atwood Ferguson Ensemble. And for more information, please contact the Los Angeles Theater Center. And for also ticket information, 213-489-7402. Once again, that's 213-489-7402. And this is a reminder, if you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. The call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now, back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. We're back with our guest, Lee Beck, the Artistic Director of Public Work Improvisational Theater Company. And I would like to get into Lee performing a couple monologue for our listening audience. Lee, what would you be performing?
I think I'll just maybe sing you a couple of songs. This one is based in our work last year with about the bombing of the Los Angeles Times. And kind of describes, and I think it has some relevance to today, it kind of describes the attitude that General Otis, who ran the Los Angeles Times, had towards working class people, kind of, especially people who wanted to be unionized. And it goes like this. Why should rich people like us have to pay for poor people like you? You people seem to have the idea that just because we have all the money, we should have to pay for everything. We shouldn't have to pay for everything just because we have all the money. Any more than you should have to pay for everything if you had all the money, which you don't. So let's just get off of that trip and simply realize we're rich and we're not paying for your poverty. Even the Bible teaches us that the poor ye shall have with you always. That's you. We're rich.
Okay. You're going to do another piece for us?
Well, this is a piece from the play that I wrote with David's help called Confessions of a Pulpiteer, and it deals with my life as a fundamentalist evangelist from the time I was 17 until I was 27, I was a preacher. I preached 50 nights in a row sometimes from coast to coast and cover to cover for the One Cup Church of Christ, which adhered to a very strict biblical interpretation. We spoke where the Bible, we speak where the Bible speaks. We're silent where the Bible is silent. We do Bible things in Bible ways and call Bible things by Bible names. And it was very scriptural oriented, so that every sermon had a scripture behind it. And I came home from school when I was a little boy one day, and I saw people in the house with my mom and dad, and my mom and dad were being converted to the One Cup Church of Christ. And they changed everything. Everything changed. Our whole life began to change. Our whole life had revolved around, and our whole life came to revolve around this big change. Pretty soon we were going to church 30 nights in a row instead of to football games and baseball games and so on. And this is a little song that begins the play, and it goes like this. My daddy is a jackleg preacher, preaching in a storefront church. He put the church out on the boulevard. Used to be a cleaner's, but now it is a church. Built a little stage up front, yeah, put in a little perch. Daddy is a big man, so he made it pretty high, because Daddy is a high podium guy. Then he got those rainbow seats from the Rainbow Theater.
where we used to go to movies when we were little boys. He got those rainbow seats from the Rainbow Theater. Where we used to go to movies when we were little boys. Pretty soon we had a church, we had a door, we had some seats, we had a little stage, we had a podium, we had songbooks in every seat. And people in those rainbow seats from the Rainbow Theater, where we used to go to movies when we were little boys. I think I might have got off tune a little there.
Okay, great. Okay, can we talk about what are some of the upcoming projects for Public Works and Improvisation?
Well, of course, our for the last for the last year or two, we've been doing a monthly poetry and storytelling event called Storyfile, which we began doing at the last bookstore, and we've recently moved it over to ArtShare, which Earlene announced, and it's coming up this Thursday night, and we'd love to have you come and enjoy it with us. And we have several really good poets and storytellers and musicians participating. We always have music, we always have stories, and we always have really good poets. And there are many, many wonderful poets. Right now, it's a big thing happening here in Los Angeles, are the numerous poetry readings going on all over town. And you can check that out on Facebook. I'm sure most people are aware of that, but you can communicate with a lot, and you can go to poetry readings all over the city. And this is one of them that we have. It's more than a poetry reading in that there's storytelling and poetry and music.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear from different musicians, and I host it, and I try to vary the people who participate on an ongoing level. And then I'll let Eric tell you about the next thing we have coming up.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Lee. Yes, on Thursday, June 13th, we're celebrating Bloomsday a few days early. But it refers to the day that all of the events in James Joyce's book, Ulysses, it all takes place in one day. And, it's June 16th, 1904, which also happened to be the day that James Joyce decided to leave Ireland forever. And so there's a special irony there, because he took with him this woman named Nora Barnacle, and they exiled themselves to Europe. And for the next 40 years, he wrote nothing but Ireland. Right up to that moment in 1904, it was like the clock stopped for him. So he had obviously had a love-hate relationship with Ireland, mm-hmm. but we've decided to tell the story and to celebrate the wit and imagination of the Irish, mm-hmm. with music and satire.
Okay,
yeah.
Sounds like a great event. Let's go around for some closing comments, and then we have Lee do the last closing comments and give us some contact information to our audience again for those who want to get in touch with the Public Works Improvisational Theater. Let's start over here. Closing comments.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to be here and also to talk about Lee and what he's been doing over the years with the Improvisational Theater. It's been a big help in my life as an artist, and this really is a way to reach people in different communities, and I'm just happy that we're able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. Lee came into my life through a good friend, and then gradually I was able to recruit him into our Reader's Theater, and then he recruited me back into Public Works. But we both share a passion for the arts and also for seeking a new generation and helping them to take voice and give voice to their concerns, but do it enriched by the arts that mm-hmm. and the classic works.
Mm-hmm.
And So I'm only too happy. We're trying to look way ahead to 2015 to the Pan Pacific Expositions, because the centenary is coming up, and that's when California really took its place on the world stage, when the Panama Canal was completed, mm-hmm. and we were sitting pretty with our contact with Asia, and. That's the story of Los Angeles, how it grew up and how it became its own little empire here.
So it's coming up 2015?
Yes, which in, seems like a while, but in these planning terms, it's nothing.
We'll begin telling stories right around about the corner. That era mm-hmm. before that time.
David?
Lee and Public Works is going to be involved not only in the story file presentations on Thursdays, but also in music concerts,
which we produce,
which Lee produces, and we're also looking at mounting a couple of different plays, a couple of different presentations on various things, political things. Let's face it, it's political.
Definitely, so
that's. That's what we're looking at. It just takes commitment and work, and that's what Lee has.
Okay. Now, Lee, I want to, something that's sticking in my head that I would like for you to comment on. The cannabis clubs in the 70s, mm-hmm. was that the foundation for most of the dispensaries and things that we have right now?
It wasn't in the 70s. It was in the 90s.
The 90s.
Yes. We got involved in the Los Angeles Cannabis Resource Center, which was at the corner of Vista and Santa Monica Boulevard, in the 90s when Marlene got ovarian cancer. And she said, let's go down there. And we went down, and this was run by a lot of fellas who had helped to pass Proposition 215. And so we got involved, and pretty soon she, and we were a heterosexual, older heterosexual couple, and most of these fellas were gay. So they were very thrilled to have us because they could expand their influence mm-hmm. and their communications. And Marlene was such a wonderful spokesperson that they made her the international spokesperson and honorary chair of the collective. And she was on television all over the world espousing medical marijuana. She was a really great advocate for that cause.
Yeah, I'd like to do a whole show on that sometime. Yeah.
I'd like to, if I could, just bring up a little personal note about that. Those of us that were around Marlene as she was sick and before she died, about 5 years, we thought Marlene was going to sing her last days. We were visiting her thing. Most of her friends were thinking that she was going to die because she had, I guess, colon cancer. And I remember being
ovarian.
And I remember being in her hospital room at Kaiser. Well, I'll just say it, in a hospital in Hollywood. And Marlene hadn't eaten hardly anything in probably a few months.
For 9 weeks.
Yeah, it had been a while. And she all of a sudden she told Lee she wanted to smoke something, and because she wanted to get hungry, I guess, and she smoked something and she started eating. She was eating potato chips, and I'll never forget the doctor walking in and going, "What is that?" And then he looks at Marlene and she's eating for the first time. I mean, really eating these potato chips. And he says, "I don't want to know what it is, but just make sure she continues doing it." So it was Marlene's own personal story. She had been helped, and the rest of us could see, well, you know, this is real. This is really helping her, and I think that gave other people inspiration, her own personal story of how it helped her, and she lived another 5 years.
Beautiful. We're winding down with a little over a minute. Can you give us about 30 seconds, and then I'll wind it on down?
Well, I'll just say that Public Works specializes in cultural activism theater that puts audiences in touch with contemporary events and their immediate personal, political, and social relevance, and that's what we try to do, and we try to service communities that don't get communicated with much and don't have, you know, so we've worked a lot with at-risk youth. We did workshops with the deaf. We intend to do more improvisational workshops in the very near future, so I invite you to sign on to our website, publicworksimprov.com, if you're interested in taking a class, or if you're interested in any of the many projects that we produce throughout the year. And we just love having you come out and participate with us.
Okay. Thank you. That's Lee Beck. Now, next week on the Qumran Report, we will have John Freeland, production stage manager for the Roby Theater Company Productions of Bronzeville, and Daryl Jones, the director of props for that production. I would like to extend a special thanks to Lee Beck, Nolan Porter, David Ruff, Eric Vollmer, and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, skidrow.la. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. And from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with Lee Beck talking about Paul Robeson singing on the streets of Harlem.
Wally Hilly was the musical director of the Unitarian Church on 8th Street here in Los Angeles for 50 years. And he was the artistic director. And this was during the time when at that church, the balcony was full because it became a hideout and a refuge and a gathering place for the blacklisted artists of Los Angeles during the 50s. And they would go there and they'd do shows and they would entertain each other as they had been entertaining the entire country, but were no longer allowed to put their names on their work, or to, in many cases, even do their work because they were labeled as communists or fellow travelers. Wally Hilly published The People's Songbook, which is a very popular songbook from that era. One time, Wally Hilly was in New York, in Harlem, with Paul Robeson. And Paul Robeson walked out on the street, Wally behind him, and all of a sudden, of course, a crowd began to gather, and people began to come from all around until the whole street was full of people, and they began to shout, "Sing for us, sing for us!" And Paul Robeson said, "Well, how can I? I don't have a piano." You know. And a whole bunch of fellas, three guys, ran up three stories of steps, picked up a piano, and carried it back down to the street and set it down next to Paul Robeson. And Wally Hilly sat down and played, and Paul Robeson sang on the streets of Harlem that day.